Welcome to the Anderson Business Advisors Podcast, the nationally recognized preferred provider for asset protection and tax planning in the nation. This show is for investors and business owners looking to save on taxes and build long-term wealth with Toby Mathis, an attorney, author, business owner, and a featured instructor at Anderson's Tax and Asset Protection event held throughout the country. Enjoy the show.
Hey guys, this is Toby Mathis.
And Jeff Webb.
And you're listening to Tax Tuesday. First off, welcome and glad you have you with us. I'm going to pull over some question and answer stuff over here, see if anybody's out there. All right, so let's jump into this thing. Obviously, yesterday was a tax day, so I'm going to go over a couple things that you could still do to recover from any tax hits that you received. There are some things you can do, actually.
We were
chatting about those earlier. But anyway, send in questions at taxtuesday@andersonadvisors.com. You can always ask questions that way. If you need a detailed response, you'll need to become a Platinum or Tax client. But if you're just asking basic questions, we throw them into this thing and we answer them. This is fast, fun, and educational. We want to give back and help educate. As always, we do not charge for answering tax questions on Tax Tuesday. And you can always go in and listen to our podcast, too. Kind of the new stuff we like to talk about, the podcast. You can go to AndersonAdvisors.com/podcast. You can go to iTunes and type in Anderson Business Advisors. You can go to Google Play and listen to the and type in Anderson and Business Advisors and get our podcast. And we break these into pieces, into two pieces, so that you can always listen to these. If you like podcasts, you can always just listen to them that way. All right, so let's just kind of dive in. Hey, April 15th is coming, Don. What moves can I make in 2018 to still impact our 2018 taxes, is a better way to put it. This is if you got kind of like you didn't expect to get hit with as big a tax bill. We're hearing about this more and more all over the country. In some polls, people were paying extra taxes in 70-some-odd percent of the time. And then somebody comes in and says, well, that's not true. You actually didn't have to pay as much tax. Well, how about this? I had to pay more tax at tax time than I'm used to, even if they didn't do enough withholding or whatever. I still got hit. In the case of many people in, I don't want to call them blue or red states, but let's say the New Yorks and the Californias of the world, they got a pretty good sized tax increase. A lot of our clients got hit, not because of anything that they did other than they happened to live in a place where their SALT deduction was limited and they hadn't taken any action to offset it. So,
yeah, and we saw a lot of that. Especially those people in some of those taxing states, that between the loss of personal exemptions and the reduction in deductible state and local taxes, they paid for it dearly.
How many people do you see really get hit where it was like a big shocker thus far? Because we're pretty early in the tax season. But
I don't want to say it's a large number, primarily because a lot of those people that have larger incomes, we haven't seen their returns yet. But we have seen quite a few people that maybe deducted $40,000 or $50,000 in state and local taxes in previous years and are only able to deduct $10,000 this year.
Yep. So what do you do in those situations? What do you do, Jeff?
Well, there's a couple things that we have to keep in mind with those state and local taxes in particular is, can we use them elsewhere? Do we have a home office where we can deduct a portion of them?
Mm-hmm. What Jeff's talking about is that a company, if you have an S-Corp or a C-Corp, it has to be an S or a C-Corp or an LLC taxed as an S or a C-Corp. I guess in theory, in some cases, if it was your only primary place,
right,
it would have to be a possibly a sole proprietor, but then you have depreciation recapture. I don't like those. So I'm going to just refer to a straight out accountable plan where the company is reimbursing an employee and the employee does not have to recognize that reimbursement as taxable income. A company can reimburse you for a chunk of your home, including the real estate taxes.
Right.
And so Jeff is basically saying, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but the company is now paying you back and it's writing it off. So you can't deduct it, but the company can.
Correct. And I may be losing some of those taxes just by the fact that I'm being reimbursed for them. Mm-hmm. But if I'm already losing $10,000, $15,000 of taxes and other means, then I don't mind being reimbursed for those.
Absolutely. So it's just a fancy way of saying, hey, I'm getting some money. Let's see. Somebody just said, when I see something that's particularly relevant, somebody says, I am an S-Corp and an also ordained minister. Is there any conflict of interest if I'm taking minister's housing allowance and taking home oxygen? Well, so what he's doing is he's getting the parsonage what is that, 105, 26 U.S.C. 105. It's a parsonage allowance for a minister where they don't have to pay tax on it. Can you get reimbursed as well?
I don't think you can, because it's already almost like a reimbursement. And with those parsonage allowances, you're not paying income tax on it, but you're still paying self-employment tax on that.
You are?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you're paying self-employment tax on those parsonages.
Huh. So I wonder whether he has any other expenses. Well, the parsonage is, I'm providing you with housing, but then there's all the utilities and everything else
right.
that you're covering up. So
right, so there's certain deductions from that amount.
Right. So I guess the way I would answer this is I would look at your actual expenses. If you're being reimbursed, you can't double dip.
Right.
Otherwise, it's taxable income. But if the parsonage allowance, I'm just trying to think of how they allocate it. I haven't read that section in a while. I just know it's not included in the taxable income of the minister.
Correct. I mean, they usually provide you a form saying how it's allocated, what part of it's for the house, what's for utilities, and so on.
Right. So we're talking about just the actual heavy cost of the house. Anything that's coming out of your pocket. So if you're a minister and you're coming out of pocket for utilities, it could be that you have people meeting you there, so you're coming out of pocket for upkeep on the outside. Even if you have a landscaper, you can then it's going to be whatever percentage of that home office represents. And so I like to, you know me, I like to use the number of room instead of the square footage. But you might be able to get 17, 20, 20, maybe 22, 23% of the house where any of those expenses you're able to reimburse. But I don't think you'd get to, if it's not something you're incurring, if it's not a rent you're paying, or if it's not a mortgage you're paying, if it's not an actual expense out of your pocket, I don't think you get reimbursed for it.
Yeah. It's an interesting question. I'm not aware of any exceptions for that, but it's possible it could be.
So switching gears. So we're still talking about what can we do for last year. So a lot of you guys are used to the April 15th deadline for IRAs and things like that. If you're a small business, you don't have to worry about those deadlines, so long as you have a retirement plan. And I think the SEP just ended on April 15th. But if you have a 401k, solo 401k, profit sharing plan, any of those, defined benefit plan, anything that the company has that sponsors, your deadline is actually when you actually file your return and the company actually files its return. So you still have time. So we have a lot of clients in that. In fact, I talked to one last night that was freaking out about the amount of tax that they owe. They didn't realize how big their tax bill was. And I said, relax, you have a defined benefit plan. How much were you able to put in there? And they said, well, it was close to $200,000 and it was two people. And I said, well, you can put $400,000 in as long as you do it before you file your return. So,
right.
You know, so September for these guys, for the S Corp. And you know, again, if it's going to save them in that particular situation, at least 37%.
I was going to say $140,000, $150,000.
Yeah, it's going to save them that much, at least. And so sometimes that's what you look at. So you want to look at those. Now, here's another one. Jeff and I were just talking about that before we got on. And this is a huge one, is the, and you've heard me talk about cost segregation. Anybody who's listened to Tax Tuesday already knows what that is. I've written about it. I've spoken about it. I'm all over the internet talking about cost segregation. I know I did a podcast with somebody on cost segregation, as is Clint, one of my partners. Cost segregation is a fancy way of saying breaking your house. Instead of using the straight line depreciation method, which is 27 and a half years or 39 years, it's commercial. So 27 and a half for residential, 39 years for commercial. Rather than just saying, hey, let's take the whole amount and do it over that, we break out components of the building into things like the carpeting, the paint, the door handles, the everything that you can think of. And it gets a time frame that it can be depreciated over. It's not all 39-year property on a commercial building. A lot of it's 5-year, 7-year, 15-year. If that's the case, then we use a second punch, which is the bonus depreciation, which is 100%, which means you could choose to write that portion off 100% in whatever year, the year you put it into service. Or if we're sitting here now, I think we can go back and we can actually grab previous years that we didn't depreciate.
Correct.
Why this is important is because that's called a change of accounting election when you do that. It's a form 3115, I believe.
That is also correct.
And you could file that all the way until you file your return this year.
Right. As a matter of fact, I think if you amend your return, you can even file that.
Yeah, I think that we... Oh, so it's like even if they didn't do it, you can still go back and...
Yeah.
So if you filed your return and you're like, oh, crap, I paid too much tax, you can go back and do the 3115 on your property?
Yeah, so if you have your accountant tell you that you can't do a 3115, you can't do that change of accounting method, That's just because they don't want to. The form's a real pain, but it's something you need to do at times. And
yeah, so here's where it's relevant. If you have a bunch of income coming off of rental properties, if you have income hitting you from rental activities, so like you, I think we saw some syndication deals, you know, you're somebody there and you have rental income and you're getting hit with some things that you didn't anticipate having so much. And I've had that conversation with several people over the last few weeks where they said, I didn't realize how much I made. And now what do I do? I'm like, well, you know, we just accelerate the depreciation. You're going to get about a 20% of the improved value, immediate tax relief. And if we just want to be kind of pigs about it, frankly, you go back and amend last year and go get some of that money back if you feel like it. We can't carry losses back, but if we change the accounting method, we could actually, it can go back 2 years. So we could literally take the big chunk of the deduction and apply it to 2017 and 2018. So like, again, we have options here. You get the choice, and people don't realize that they actually have that option and they have that choice. Now, if you're a real estate professional, now we can really dig into this thing. You know, even if you're not making money in your rentals, well, we can create more loss. And if you're a real estate professional, we can make that statement on your return, then we could take that and offset your W-2 income and your other profits. So I don't want anybody to ever feel like they are just completely out of luck. There are some things you can do. Other things you can do. You go into the business and you look at all the expenses and you make sure that if you had a choice on when to expense something, maybe you're accelerating it. Maybe you were being too conservative and you decide, hey, now that you have a stronger incentive, maybe it's time to take a little more aggressive position on certain expenses. This is so I can make Jeff's hair fall out. Right. He loves it when you talk about aggressive positions. No, you know, you have to do it within the realm of the law, but you can take an aggressive. It's like allocation of how much personal use I have on things. What comes down to is what kind of record keeping I have. And did I take a very conservative position because I didn't think it was worth it being aggressive? And now all of a sudden I have extra income. It's all in the 37% tax bracket or something. Maybe I have an incentive now to take a more aggressive position.
And that whole allocation discussion of how much you may allocate for expense, keep in mind that's kind of a year-by-year calculation. So if you maybe deducted 40% of some kind of cost as a current year expense in the past year, that's not necessarily what that expense is going to be for this year. So we kind of look at it each year, and maybe in certain years we do have a reason to be more aggressive.
Yep. And so I've done this many, many times, that even in my own businesses. You go through and you say, all right, we kept books. Now let's go back and really start taking a critical look at what some of the expenses were, and let's see if we missed anything.
Right.
It's not worth it if you don't have much of a tax liability. It is worth it if you're facing down a big tax liability. And sometimes you have the choice. Do I take an expense now? Was I going to allocate it over 5 years? Do I have a choice? Can I accelerate it? Can I use bonus depreciation? Can I 179 something? And I may not have been aware that actually certain expenses I can take bigger. Or in a greater pace, faster pace, so I can take them faster. A couple questions. Hey, somebody asked two things that are very relevant to this. Number one, they said, hello, new to this type of planning. Aside from the $5,500 IRA, $3,500 HSA, are there any other allowed? I just opened my HSA. As an individual, so first off, Claudia, you're late. You can't do any more on the IRA. Some of the planning you can. If you have real estate, then yeah, we have some options. If you have a small business that's an S corp or a C corp or an LLC taxed as an S or a C corp, yeah, there are some things we can do. So that's first off. But as an individual, you're out of luck right now as far as like we can affect the business, which might affect the personal.
But yeah, the IRA and the HSA are both shut down for last year.
That was as of yesterday. Somebody asked about the house. And a lot of people, what they'll do is, let's say you have a home and an office, and the typical accountant will say, all right, how big is your house? So it's 2,000 square feet. How big is the office? It's 100 square feet. And they'll measure it out. And then they'll say, okay, then we can write off that proportion. So 1/20th, which is, what is that, 5%.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which that's not going to get me very excited. Frankly, I think that's probably the IRS's approved method because it's the worst for the taxpayer. You can use any method that's a reasonable method. I think there's like 9 or 10 of them.
But right.
The best ones, like you could exclude all of the non-usable square footage in your house. So when you use the 2,000, that's like, hey, we're adding everything up together. You have hallways and stuff.
Closets.
You got it. Closet. What else could be thrown in there?
Stairways are out.
Yep. So at a minimum, you could immediately go and say, let's measure those out and remove them. So now instead of 2,000 square feet, you might get down to 1,500. And now you have 1/15, which I don't know what that percentage is, but it's more. So it's close to 7%. Mm-hmm. That's still not very exciting. So one of the methods that some of the better practitioners use, in my personal opinion, is you count the number of rooms. If you have basically the same number of rooms and you say, all right, we have 6 rooms, 7 rooms, 8 rooms, whatever, a fairly equal size, then you just take 1/6 and you're going to get a lot more bang for your buck,
right?
Immediately. That's an approved method. If the IRS wants to come in, they're not going to be, you know.
I've never seen them come in with tape measures and.
Nope. The only thing they really care about is that used for your business? Exclusively. In other words, they used to say, like, what, you know, the computers, do they have games on them? Oh, we're going to deny you. Well, here's the thing. The traditional home office is what a sole proprietor does, and that's, you have to recapture that for depreciation, all this fun stuff. That sucks. We don't do that.
Right.
What we do is we do an accountable plan employee reimbursement where you don't have to pay tax on it and the company can write it off. That's something very different, and there's 4 different categories of home office in that case that can be reimbursed. The easiest one is an administrative office where you do your administrative services for your business. And it doesn't even have to be the principal office of the business. Where you do your administrative services, that is treated as a home office. Whereas when you're doing the home office deduction, it has to be the principal place of the business. We don't play that game. So we go straight to where we can get it. We don't have to pay tax on it. We love it. And let's just say you got 1/6. I don't know what that number is, but you're going to get to write off. If you have a $12,000 property tax bill, you're going to get 1/6 of it. So you can reimburse yourself $2,000. Now you're not crying because you didn't get to write off. If it was over $10,000, you lost the $2,000. Well, here you just got the $2,000 back through your business. So yay, we win. That's what we love. Let's see. Somebody says about 2018. So we're talking about going back into last year. They talked about the net investment income tax. He got surprised by a net investment income tax. We need to take a look at it. The way I always look at it is anytime you get hit by something you didn't expect, then you should have a second set of eyeballs, take a look at it and see whether there's any way around it. So net investment income tax is when you're over $250,000. And it's passive income.
Is that or portfolio income.
Portfolio income. Well, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, capital gains, dividends,
interest. You are such an accountant. Oh, my God. I was going to do a section on the 3 different types of income because I always say passive and active. But it's actually passive, active, and portfolio. I was literally.
I have people say estimates when they mean it and yeah. Mean extensions, and that makes me crazy. So
yeah.
Passive, I'm an accountant.
Passive is real estate or activities in which you don't materially participate. Portfolio is royalties, interest, dividends. And capital gains.
Right.
At least I remember that part. Shoot. You're killing me. You're killing me, Smalls. But anyway, so the net investment income tax is on those passive and portfolio income. So if you can reduce it, guess what happens? Down goes your net investment income tax. And we just talked about a way to reduce that income, which is the cost segregation and rapidly depreciating. There's other ways to do it, too. So, yeah.
And, you know, one of the biggest surprises I see, especially with capital gains, is when somebody has a large capital gain and they're expecting 15% tax. And instead, it turns out to be 23.9% tax because they got the 20% capital gains tax plus that net investment income tax we were just talking about.
Plus the state tax.
Plus the state tax. And
mm-hmm. It can be a little sneakers. Or you lower your income. Are there ways to lower your income? Yeah, there are ways to lower your income too.
Right.
So obviously we'd prefer to be doing this stuff during the tax year in which all this stuff's going on. But you're never completely out of luck until you file that final return. And then even if you file that final return, sometimes we can go back and amend it and get it back anyway. So I don't want you to lose hope. Charlie asked a question. Do you have to pay back the home office depreciation when you sell the house? On a home office,
yes.
Unless it's an accountable plan and you're being reimbursed, then no. So the home office for a sole proprietor, different animal. We don't like it.
So here's the whole crazy side of that is my company can reimburse me for depreciation, but I don't have to recapture that depreciation.
Yes. In fact, you literally capture it. Like if you guys have ever seen my cheat sheet, come to TaxWise. If you love to get into this stuff, you want to geek out with me. I do a little, I have a calculator and we actually go through and say, well, here's the depreciation that we'd be allowed to take. The IRS gives us the calculator. That's how comical it is. So you can reimburse. So here's how weird it is. I have an S-Corp and it's going to make $100,000. Oh, nuts. And I don't get to write off my SALT deduction. I don't get to do all these things. That same S-Corp could say, hey, Toby, I'm going to reimburse you for 1/6 of the property taxes, 1/6 of the depreciation on your house. You're, you know, hey, this is one room out of 6. So I'm going to reimburse you all the expenses, including your cleaner, including your utilities, including anything that's associated with that house, and I'm going to write you a check for it, and it's going to lower that $100,000 down to, let's say, $85,000. I don't have to report that anywhere, and I just lowered my taxable income to $85,000.
Right.
That's how it works. Yay. So now, why I've been on one slide all day. All right. So the answer is, when you're doing the accountable plan, you do not have to recapture that depreciation. If you're not, then you do. Somebody says, if you have 2 bedrooms and work in one and the other for administration, does that count? So he's talking about a 2-bedroom property. I'd probably say you're going to have to call the other rooms a room. So I'd probably say, take a look. And if you just, like, you're in a small apartment, then yeah. In fact, we have it where it's a standalone house. It works.
Mm-hmm.
We have clients with 2 houses, one that's business and one that's personal. Yeah, they can write off it.
Yeah, but yeah, you're still going to have to count that living area in your kitchen. Bathrooms, I think, are out, correct?
Bathrooms are out. Yeah.
Bathrooms are not included in that.
Yep, bathrooms are not, but only the usable space. And frankly, we don't really know because the IRS doesn't have a definition for it.
That's right.
The reason, but like, we have other ones we could use up our sleeve to be a little.
Yeah, I think that was one of the IRS's. We'll get back to you.
Yeah. So somebody says, does the accountable plan require the business to be a corporation? It has to be a separate party in which you can be an employee. You cannot be an employee of your own partnership or sole proprietor. So yes, you need to be an S or a C corp. It could be an LLC tax as an S or a C. Somebody asked a really technical question here. For reporting installment income on 6252, you familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Do you also need to submit form 4787? 4797, sorry about that.
Yes, the 6252 ends up feeding into the 4797, which probably feeds into Schedule D, that feeds into the 1040.
That's your gain, right?
Yeah, right.
Yes.
So, yeah, the 6252, just so everybody understands, that's your installment sale form. 4797 is sale of business property. Schedule D is capital gains. And then everybody hopefully knows what a 1040 is.
Mm-hmm. Oh, somebody else asks, oh, you guys really love this home office. Like, I talk about the home office deduction so often and nobody ever shoots me. Now I got like 20 questions. Here's some cool ones. Is that accounting debt plan part of any entities that Anderson creates, especially like if I did one in 2013? Yes. If it's a corporation. So if it's an S or a C or an LLC tax as an S or a C, you have that. Technically, accountable plans don't have to be in writing, though we always suggest that they are. So you're not completely out of luck if you don't have it. When you have an accountable plan and you use the room method for the home office, can you also include your homeowner's insurance? Yes. Along with property taxes? Yes. Mortgage? Yes. Utilities? Yes. To a landscaper can be included as well. I did talk about the landscaper being included, but there, the only time you're allowed to do the landscaper is if it's a meeting office for your clients. That's the only time. So if you have people coming there, so I was thinking of the minister is probably having people coming into his home, then yes. If you have people meeting at your house, then you can write off the landscaping. Otherwise, no. Hey, we got a whole bunch of stuff we have to jump into. You guys are, I love the questions. All right, here's the questions we're going to go over today, even though we're like way into this. Somebody asked, what about improvements like a bathroom renovation? No, unless it's specifically for your business. Like if you have people meeting you in your home and you have a bathroom that's used exclusively for your clients, then possibly. Otherwise, I would just say no.
Right.
Pigs get fat, hogs get slaughtered, guys. All right, so let's jump back in. So I was going through these questions. Are there advantages to moving our software business into an opportunity zone? The second one is, I borrowed $100,000 from my cash value life insurance policy at 5% and loaned it to my Wyoming Holding LLC at 8%. And then I turned and loaned that back out at 12%. How do I deduct the 5%? We'll go into that. Did the new Tax Cut and Jobs Act help big businesses more than small businesses? The answer is yes. But we'll go into the reasons why. Jump in. Should I use my tax refund towards paying an estimated quarterly taxes for 2019? If I overpay the estimate, will I have to pay taxes on future refunds? So we'll answer that. How are distributions from a limited partnership positioned in an apartment syndication taxed? If you pay all estimated taxes due before year end, fine-tuned for year end's earning, will there be a penalty if you do not pay quarterly estimated taxes? And then the last question we're going to go over today is, investor owns 20 single-family homes and 8-unit complex in Florida, all rented out. Can we use accelerated depreciation such as new roof, AC, kitchen and bathroom remodels? If so, what's the percentage and time frame? We'll go over all of those. So we got to jump into the first one. And you guys, I apologize. I have about 1,000. Yeah, all these chats are coming, all these questions. So I'll make sure that we get to all your questions. I'll just have to sort through them a little bit. Whew, there's a lot. All right. Are there any advantages to moving our software business into a designated opportunity zone? Jeff, what do you think?
I don't think there is. If you're an existing business, you're not going to get any advantage from moving in an opportunity zone.
All right. So let's go back and break this into little pieces first off.
Okay.
Opportunity zones. They are a creature of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act. They came about at the end of 2017 and first showed up in 2018. All states designated certain zip codes as economically disadvantaged areas that need investment. That's what an opportunity zone is. And there's a that you can actually go read about it. It's 26 USC 1400Z because they put a big Z for zone.
That's right.
It's 1 and 2. All right. So we'll keep going this. So the opportunity zone are these economically disadvantaged areas where the government wants basically investment. And the way it works is if you invest in one of those areas and you hold the investment, and what it really comes down to is you invest in something called a fund, an opportunity zone fund, and it invests 90% of its capital into opportunity zone property, which could be a business, it could be real estate there under certain circumstances, and you hold it for 10 years, any gain on that property, you do not have to pay tax on. You hold it for 20 years, zero gain. No capital gains. So if I buy a business or I invest in a business and it's worth $1 million and it goes up to 10 million, I pay nothing on that, all that gain. Certain real estate will work if you double the improved value of that. Like you have to invest right. as much cash as the improvement's worth. So we always use examples like if you put $1 million into the opportunity zone, you buy a property at 600,000, 200 is its land, 400 is its improved value. You just need to put $400,000 into that the first 31 months. You have 31 months to do it and it works. Now, what's kind of weird is there's two pieces to this. There's that side, and then there's also a deferral side. And the deferral side says if you've had a capital gain event, and as long as you take those gains and invest it into the opportunity zone within 180 days, then you do not have to pay tax on that for up to 7 years. And then when you do pay tax on it, you only pay tax on 85%. If you wait at least 5 years, you only pay on 90%. And then after 7 years, you get what's called a step up of 15%. So you only pay tax on 85% of it. So there's those sides. So that's why people do opportunity zones, is you get deferral for 7 years. You get a reduction in the amount that you end up having to pay. That's equivalent to about 15%. And then you pay nothing on any of the gain. So let's go back to your question. If you have a software business, and would there be an advantage to moving into the opportunity zone? There could be if you're acquiring real estate in that area, if you're acquiring another property, another software business, or if you're seeking investment. So if I moved my business into the opportunity zone and then said, I want to go raise money, now you have a pretty good reason why somebody would want to give you money. But you couldn't be the one who gets the real benefit because you're the one who's kind of, you already own it. So you're disqualified. So you can't do it on your own business. And that, someone's asked me, that code provision was 26 USC 1400Z, 1400Z. All right, let's keep going. All right, I borrowed $100,000 from my cash value life insurance policy at 5%, loaned it to my LLC, taxes of partnership. I would probably collapse that, by the way. And then I did a bridge loan at 12%. Can I deduct the 5% as an investment expense? What say you, Jeff?
I agree. I would collapse that. So actually, it's a loan to the LLC, not to you.
Yeah. That's how I would treat it.
Right.
I'd say you really, it's an investment expense if it's the partnerships.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if there's any advantage to generating income on one side and then having to find a place to deduct the 5% personally.
I would ignore this thing from a personal standpoint, and I would just treat it all as part of the partnership.
Yep.
And I would say I really what it is that partnership has a expense ratio of 5%, so I would just have it grabbing the 7% as the income. I'd be deducting the 5%. So you don't need to do the three pieces. You don't need, because you really can't loan it to your own holding entity unless you have other partners. I mean, I guess if they have a third party, even
right.
Even then that would be weird. Really what you did is you have a contribution.
And maybe if they had one entity loaned to another entity.
Maybe.
If the first entity was in the business of financing.
Yes, that's the big issue. You and me, it's hard for us to be a business
right.
lender. An entity, yes, it can. So the entity here definitely is. It's doing bridge loans. So it gets to take the 5%. That's the easiest path. Let's go the path of least resistance, is you'd write it off. You'd have zero, and it would just offset the income that it brings in by the 5%. So you're going to get to the same point of getting to write it off.
Right.
All right. Did the new Tax Cut and Jobs Act help big business more than small businesses? Heck yeah. I mean, that was the whole point of it, is that it said, hey, we're going to cut corporate taxes from the high of 39% down to 21%. They knocked it almost in half. That would be like if we took the highest tax bracket from 37 and dropped it down to 22. Yeah, this is going to be a huge benefit. What they did is they gave small businesses something called a 199A deduction, which is the 20% haircut on flow-through businesses. So they said, if you're a corporation, you get almost a 50% tax cut. As an individual, we'll give you a 20%. So you tell me which one's better.
Now, the one I like to talk about, and it is the small corporation that has taxable income between $0 and $50,000 a year. They're actually paying more tax under the new tax code, because prior to the new tax code, if $50,000 or less of corporate income was taxed at 15%, and now everything's taxed at 21%. So, yeah.
Somebody's asking, what's the difference between big and small business?
If you're IRS or, say, a big four CPA firm, a large business is probably $100 to $500 million is their bottom side of that. I think when I was in large business and at IRS, we consider large businesses over $100 million in revenue.
Mm-hmm. I would just say it's any big business that has multiple owners.
Mm-hmm.
Any small business is really just you, maybe a small group.
Yeah, because the corporate tax rate, highest tax rate, really kicked in at a low level. Right around $100,000, you were already paying 35%. So in that aspect, I think there's other things been done that have affected the large companies that don't affect small companies.
Mm-hmm. Long time, you know, we'll actually see the big impacts. Like what we'll be able to see once we have the IRS data book,
mm-hmm.
which should come out. Oh, shoot. It'll be a year and a half from now, won't it? Last year's
yeah.
will be coming out in October. Yeah, but it's going to take us a while to really see the impact, guys. Like, I already have my hunch because I've been asking, I've done a bunch of polls in different groups and asked, you know, where did your income go up and where did it go down? What we'll see is how much revenue they're generating and from whom. And my guess is audit rates on businesses have been going down.
Right.
Well, frankly, they've gone down on individuals too a little bit. I think we're at a total audit rate of about 0.7, which is less than 1%. But we've seen the corporate audit rates drop and the amount of revenue generated continue to go down. The vast majority comes from individuals. And I have a feeling that that's going to be exacerbated under this Tax Cut and Jobs Act.
And the information that IRS has provided on refunds is they do say refunds have gone down about 2%.
Yeah.
The data they don't keep is taxes owed.
We will see that in the data.
We'll see that in a year and a half, but
yep.
we don't know what that is right now.
Nope. So, yeah. So it's always frustrating. You have a big delay. So we have a delay on the returns almost a year because we'll be filing our final, our individual returns in October.
6 months, yeah.
Yep. They'll be giving us the data from 2017, is it? In sometime in the fall. Yeah. So it's like the 2017 data book was for, or 2018 data book was for 2016. So, yeah, we're really not going to have a good idea on this one for another year and a half. But again, everybody kind of knows just by looking at the tea leaves. I think that if you're in a blue state, you got hammered. I think that especially for high income earners, that's going to force people to do something. If you're a big company with a C-Corp, you got a big, big kiss
mm-hmm.
from the government.
Attention all real estate investors, business owners, stock traders, and anyone looking to get out of the rat race for good. We all know time is money, but did you know there's a wealth of resources on how to make more money, keep more money, and protect what you've earned all for free online? Anderson Business Advisors YouTube channel offers free resources on asset protection and tax reduction from lawyers and CPAs designed to help you keep more money in your pocket. To learn how to limit your liability, protect what you've earned, and minimize your tax burden all for free, subscribe to Anderson Business Advisors on YouTube today.
All right. Should I use my tax refund towards paying estimated quarterly taxes for 2019? If I overpay the estimate, will I have to pay taxes on future refunds?
So one of our suggestions is that when you make an extension payment, you go ahead and include that first quarter's payment with your extension. Since you're not able to deduct federal taxes, you never have to pay taxes on refunds from IRS. So it never hurts to overpay the estimates. It only hurts to underpay the estimates.
Mm-hmm. So you're not going to be hurt. You're not going to pay taxes on the future refund. And yeah, should you apply it? It depends on how much your quarterly taxes are.
Right. I usually like, if I have a client with a substantial overpayment that has to make quarterly estimates anyway, I usually like to apply some part of that overpayment.
Yeah, it's easy rather than writing them a check.
Then you go through April and even June and not pay any taxes and make your first payment in September.
Yep, easy answer. How are distributions from a limited partnership position in apartment syndication taxed? I love these that seem like they're really simple. And then I did the dance with somebody on this not so long ago. What they did is they had you're a limited partner, which means you're not participating and you're not at risk. What happens in a lot of apartment syndications is they say, hey, you put in 100 grand and we're going to give you back not just your 100 grand within a year. We're going to give you that plus a bunch of money and we're not going to have any income. Yeah, figure that one out. What they do is they go fix up the apartment, they refi it, and then they distribute a bunch of that cash. If you've done that, you always get your money back tax free. So the way it works is I have a capital account. So if I put money into a syndication, I can always get that money back tax-free.
Right.
If I get a loss, then I'm limited, because I'm a limited partner, unless I'm at risk. So I can't use a lot of that loss. If I have income, it doesn't matter what I have going on. I have to pay tax on that income if it's issuing me a K-1 with income on it. If it gives me back more cash than I put in and I don't have basis, I don't have risk, then I have to call that long-term capital gains. This is what's bizarre. So again, so what a typical situation is, promoter of apartment says, hey, we're going to fix this apartment up and we need $500,000 from the investment pool. We have financing on the rest. And we're going to get a whole bunch of cash out of this thing right after we fix it. It's the buy, rehab, rent, refi model, the BRRRR model. And then you take the money and you go do it again. Well, the way they take the money out is they issue it to the owners. And if you put in 100 and you got back 150, you're going to pay tax on that 50, even if there's no income from it, even if the depreciation is keeping there from being any reportable income.
Right.
So that's how it is. So something that looks so easy from an accounting standpoint can be an absolute kick in the shin. But
you got an extra 50 out of it.
Yeah. It's like, hey, can't be mad. If you pay all estimated taxes due before the year end, fine-tuned for the year's earning, will there be a penalty if you do not pay quarterly estimated taxes? So you pay all of your taxes before the end of the year, but you didn't pay your quarterlies, you're still going to have underpayment.
You're going to have what's called the estimated tax penalty because IRS wants you to pay this money in quarterly. Now, there are a few ways to get around this. Say you made your estimates December 31st or December 15th. But you earned all your money. You made a huge profit in December. What we can do is actually annualize your estimated taxes. That is saying that most of your income was earned during a specific period. So the tax was due during that period instead of back in early in the year. So that's one way to kind of alleviate this estimated tax penalty.
This is why you hire an accountant. Yeah, that is funny.
One quick word on going back to the question about overpayments. The nice thing about an overpayment is it doesn't quite count as an estimated tax payment. It's count it more like withholding, which means it's considered having been taken out throughout the year. So it actually has a better chance of saving you from estimated tax penalties.
That's good.
Withholding is the same thing. Withholding is always a better result than estimated tax payments.
Yep. Hey, we have one that's still related to that LP. Somebody likes somebody received a K-1, and this is interesting. It has to do with the 199A deduction, and they had a note on their K-1 that said, this property is under triple net lease agreement and does not meet the definition of qualified trade or business under IRC Reg 1.199AB14. Does that mean I don't get the 20% QBI deduction or something else? No, it means exactly that. It doesn't qualify as qualified business income, and that's the only type of rental activity that does not, is triple net leases on commercial
right.
property. So if you get that through your LP, then you're not going to get that 20% deduction. Otherwise, you possibly can. So it's kind of weird in an LP, I guess, to completely pass.
Yeah,
you still get it.
Right. Because it has that real estate factor.
Yep. So let's see. Let me jump to the next one. Investor owns 20 single-family homes in an 8-unit complex in Florida, all rented out. Can we use accelerated depreciation for things like a new roof, AC, kitchen and bathroom remodels? If so, what's the percentage and time frame? All right. So let's break that down. First off, you have 20 single-family homes in 8-unit complex. You can use accelerated depreciation even if you don't fix them up. If you fix them up, you can use accelerated depreciation, but just remember what it is. You're taking property that is less than 20 years under bonus depreciation and taking it all in year one. So we're breaking the property into those pieces. So let's take a look at the items you just mentioned. New roof, that is longer than 20 years. AC. That is going to be less than 20 years. We can write that off probably under, depending on what type of property it is. We may even be able to 179 that, but we don't really care about that. We're just going to bonus depreciate it. Kitchen and bathroom remodels, depending on what you're putting into that bathroom and kitchen, yeah, like let's think about this. You spend a whole bunch of money fixing up that kitchen, and inside it, there's appliances. Inside it, there's fixtures and things like that. All of that stuff is not, that's not 27 and a half year property. I'm going to be writing that off right away. I'd still do the appliances I do no matter what, because they're easy to break out.
Right.
But everything else that's part of it, I'd be breaking out. I'd have somebody do it. What's the percentage and time frame? The average is about 20 to 40% in the first year that you're grabbing and taking as bonus depreciation, which means what's the average? Probably about 20% is less than 27 and a half year property. And it's anywhere from 20 to 40%. What's the time frame? We talked about that. You can go back. You can grab depreciation you missed. You can actually do your 3115 election, which is the change of accounting method that allows you to do the accelerated depreciation. You could do that. You can carry it back 2 years, or you could do it the year of and carry it back a year. So, yeah, that's how it is. You can get a huge benefit. We love this. Did you see what that question was?
I did. Diane asked, in 2018, we had a personal rental property held in our own name. We created a new LLC to a disregarded entity, since just me and my spouse are on it, but did not get time to quit claim it into the LLC in 2018. It happened in early 2019. So in 2018, all the revenue came to them personally in 2019 for the first 5 months. It also came to them personally.
It's not going to matter.
Yeah, it's not going to matter. Because keep in mind, this is disregarded. I'm assuming that it's still disregarded to you.
Yep.
So for tax purposes and even accounting purposes, nothing has changed.
Nope. Everything's going to come down to you. That's actually not the hard one.
Oh, did I read the wrong one?
I'm horrible. I get
you
fired
said
today.
Diane.
I'm going to fire myself today. I know I highlighted the wrong one, and I gave you the one that's kind of this weird 59AE for $4,800. Just this weird thing on a foreign partner and stuff. So we'll get into that. So Diane, you're good. It's not going to matter. It's flowing under your Schedule E no matter what. Somebody else asked, is a disregarded subsidiary of a Wyoming holding partnership lends money? Would it be considered business income? No. If it's anything that's a loan, it's not business income. And if it's a disregarded subsidiary, they're treated as one entity for tax purposes. You can't loan yourself money. So, Billy, you do not have to do much with that. They're going to be on one return, which, just to give you an idea of how weird it is, you have a disregarded entity underneath. You could have 30 disregarded entities underneath a single LLC, and you still only file the one tax return for the parent LLC, unless that's a disregarded entity to you, in which case it all goes to you. So, kind of cool.
Yeah, 59AE, I believe, applies specifically to corporations.
Right. So here's a question. So they have a limited partnership, and they have a GP that is a C corp at 10%. On my K-1 for the corp, it shows box 20C in a statement on the LP return says gross receipts for section 59AE for $4,800. That's probably your 10%, right?
Yeah, but I don't think it's going to apply to them because they're a small corporation.
Right. It's letting you know what portion of that income would be used in that calculation. You do not need to do anything. Why are they doing it? Because they have huge corporations all the time, and they're going to be checking that just to be safe so that that company knows that that's what they're doing.
Yeah, so if you've had a corporation that gets a K-1, this is not necessarily new. There were other codes that only apply to corporations, and there's codes that only apply to nonprofits.
Right.
It's just information they're required to.
And Robert responded, the 10% is the $4,800, which means you made about $48,000, and 10% automatically goes under the corporate books. And you don't have to worry about it. Why did I see this on my LP in Corp? It's just because they're checking a box just in case it's 480. Okay, he said he made $4,800. Yeah, it's not going to matter. A, you should be expensing that thing off pretty easy. Frankly, I'd probably make the whole $4,800 disappear if you have a partnership there. So I'm not going to be too worried about it, but I can see he's saying it. They're just doing a safety check. You don't have to worry about it. They're just basically, it's almost like the gentleman that had the LP return where it said that this is not qualified business income. All they're doing is letting you know, hey, this is corporate. This is C corp income that would be used towards this calculation, and you're way underneath the calculation. So I wouldn't worry about it too much unless I'm missing something here. Somebody asks, I'm entangled with a partner, 50% owner on title in an apartment building where I put up 100% of the funds for initial investment and the mortgage is in my name. The partner performs the property management and receives the same monthly cash flow proceeds as I do. How do you suggest I divvy up for tax purposes? Well, if they're receiving a set amount, that's called a guaranteed payment to partner. I would just call that, we're going to have to break this into pieces. If you are in a partnership, then you're going to be hopefully controlled by a partnership agreement. If one partner is entitled to a certain dollar amount, then they would get that as a guaranteed payment no matter what. So if you're paying them a property management, that would reduce the amount of taxable income you then have that's being split up amongst you. If what you're saying is that they're working and their portion, because they're working, they get one half of the income, that's something completely different. Then they are receiving active income and you would be a passive investor in that. And so they would receive half of the income. You would receive half the income. Their half of the income would be active for tax purposes. Do you see anything I'm missing on that one?
No, it's really important when we create these partnership agreements that all of this is laid out. Profit and losses, who owns what, because ultimately that partnership agreement is going to determine much of this.
Mm-hmm. Hey guys, real quick, tax-wise, if you guys like tax planning, if you like this sort of thing, join us for the next one in June, the TaxWise workshop. You can always come in and attend live if you're platinum. You probably get tickets to do live. If you don't want to attend live, I can give you the recording from January of this year, and you're going to get the live stream. You can watch and attend live while sitting at home. So you can watch the actual event, chat, and get your questions answered and all that fun stuff and get the recording. All that's $197. So AndersonAdvisors.com/341. That'll get you there if you like this sort of thing. There's two tax strategies that I'm going to be adding to the TaxWise in much greater detail. One is solar. I've come up with a strategy on that one that I am 99.9%. I'm going to have an opinion done on it one more time. But this is really cool on solar. There's a way that just by investing I think I did the numbers on $30,000 and you're getting $18,000 in benefit back. So it's almost like you're cutting the cost of doing that on rental properties or things like that by almost 70-80%. And again, I could go into those things. There's accountable plans and all that fun stuff. Somebody says, unfortunately, there's no written agreement between the partners. Cassandra. So, you know, that's going to be a tough one. You're going to be following underneath the state in which you entered into this agreement. So wherever the property is held, you're going to be underneath those state laws. You're going to want an attorney on this one. If it's your cash and they're and you're tangled up in that, that's a recipe for disaster. So you're almost better off just becoming a lender in that thing and getting the property back. Or if you have any sort of writing back and forth, then you're going to want to make sure that you get this thing into a partnership agreement sooner than later. As far as the profits, it's any two parties getting together for to make a profit. That's a partnership as far as the IRS is concerned. So you're a partnership. It's just making sure that you don't get taken advantage of. Somebody asked me about the ROBs. I'm hoping to address the ROB structure for investment property construction. Things like what services you provide and the pros and cons, expected payback, et cetera. All right. So what a ROB is a rollover as a business startup. And what that is where you're partnering with your own retirement plan. It has to be a C Corp.
Yep.
So immediately take investment property out of the mix. I would not use this with investment property. I would use this only if I'm going to run an active business. And then what it basically says is, hey, I'm a disqualified person for transactions, but I'm not a disqualified person to partner with my retirement plan. And the IRS gives us a ton of guidance on ROBs because they were so misused and abused. And they say exactly how to do it. It is a one-time funding. And what you're doing is you're setting up a corporation with no stock yet. And first, you set up a retirement plan. And the retirement plan is essentially rolling your plan into that retirement plan that invests in the corporation. At the same time, you're dumping in money in as well. That's how it works. I do not like to, I say no more than I say yes on ROBs just because they are so ripe for problems. And because you can only fund once, you put yourself in a real bad situation if you run into capital needs. So I tend not to do it.
Yeah. I mean, if you don't do it exactly in the order you said, it fails.
Mm-hmm.
You get your steps out of order, it's not going to work.
Yep. And there's some bad stats to back us up, so we don't like it. Hey, if you have questions, go to Tax Tuesday at Anderson Advisors and or visit us online at AndersonAdvisors.com. You can always come and listen. I still got some more questions to go over, but I wanted to give you this. I wanted to give these to you guys so you get an idea or that you guys know what to do to answer questions and also let you know. You can always subscribe to the podcast. We have a lot more than just the Tax Tuesday. We do a lot of interviews. I had a really cool one. The guy that was the producer, he does big show productions and has done he did Parliament back in the day, and now he's done Paul McCartney, and he runs a really cool charity called Santa's Roadies, and it's fun when you get those guys on, or Meg Boozing, who was a traumatic head injury survivor who took that and created just a fantastic nonprofit, Camp You Can, in the Midwest, and does a fantastic job. I actually did a TED Talk, just a great, great, great story. And so I get those folks in, and of course, we do a lot on tax. All right, let's go back to your guys' questions. Do I need to be a Platinum member to get my question answered? No, if it's a basic question. So here's a question that you asked. When you can you guys answer this question? Can you defer taxes on capital gains on the sale of property if you put it toward an existing residential mortgage? No, you cannot. The only way you can defer capital gains that I know of right now, and we're talking about wholesale deferral, is I'm doing a 1031 exchange and I'm putting it into more property. I'm selling it and I'm putting it into an opportunity zone that's going to defer me for 7 years. Or I'm breaking it up and I'm doing an installment sale and I'm going to take it over a period of years. And I'm still going to recognize the capital gains, return of basis is zero. Appreciation recapture is 0 to 25%, depending on my tax bracket. And then my interest income is my ordinary bracket. So I break those into pieces. Or if it's your residential home and you're just refiing it, that is not taxable to you. If you're refiing your residential home and you're using it for something other than improving your house, it's not deductible under the new tax code as mortgage interest. If you're taking the money out of your home and you're investing it, then we deduct that on your Schedule E for the investment property. If you're selling your home, then if you lived in it 2 out of 5 years before selling, then you could exclude up to, as a married couple, $500,000 of capital gains. And there's some period of non-use if you used to use it as a rental. So there's some little rules there, but those are the ways to do it. So I just shot those out at you. Sorry. That was like a big blah all evolving. When trading 1256 contracts, what's the best entity to go through? Well, so John, you're 1256, you're getting that long-term gain of 60%, short-term gain of 40%. Right. And I think, is there a way to reclassify those? I can't remember. I think it's Forex where you can say 988 or 1256.
Oh, I forget. I see what you're saying.
But no, so the 1256 contracts, I would have that go through a flow-through entity. So it's either a limited partnership or an LLC. LLC taxed as a partnership if you have a corporate partner. It depends on what you're doing and whether you're trying to get tax relief. At a minimum, those are really good, by the way, 1256 contracts. That's really great. 50% long-term capital gains, 40% short-term. None of it's going to be subject to old age, death and survivors, or Medicare. So it's actually really good. When leased, most six-bed residential care facility for the elderly are usually taxed as triple net. Since they're all residences, does that make them qualify for the 20%? So Ken, no. A triple net lease is the exclusion for sure in commercial. And I think they're going to treat you the same way. Even if it's residential. So I know you're doing the assisted living. I have units. I have, I think, four units that are leased to runner, you know, people that run adult residential facilities. And in my case, it's for disabled folks, and they're not triple nets in my case. So take a look and just make sure there's some nuances as far as transferring all the responsibility on the taxes and everything to the other party. But don't get hung up on that 20% qualified business income thing. I mean, it's neat and all, but you kind of jump through some hoops and there's some phase outs depending on how much you make. Let's see. Here's somebody. It says, when I record an expense, maybe an office desk for our S-Corp, service income, no problem. Do I need to record the sales tax? I paid into a separate account in QuickBooks. So if you buy a desk for your business, you're paying sales tax on it.
Right. And that is included in the cost of that equipment, right.
Yep.
Desk.
You add it in, John. So you're going to pay tax on it. Yeah. The only time you don't pay sales tax is, and even this is like when you're used to be, you do the Amazon thing and you order everything. You still have use tax on things that you didn't, like most states have a use tax. So they're going to get you either way. But you just add it into the cost of the item. You don't have to separately state it. Unless you're going to resell that desk. Like unless you're buying furniture for the with the idea that you're going to resell it, then you're going to have to pay the sales tax. Unless I'm missing something.
No. And on the other side, if you're selling stuff and you're collecting sales tax, that's not income to you and it's not an expense to you. It's
what is it?
When you're collecting sales tax on sales that you made.
Right. When I collect sales tax, then
it's not income. It's not expense.
You're collecting it on behalf of somebody else.
Right.
You just have to pay that over. Unless you're an Indian, which is like, this is going to sound horrible, but I just think it's so awesome that there's an Indian casino on Highway 10 right before Palm Springs. I'm not going to say the name, but they collect the California state sales tax and they don't remit it to the state because they don't have to. I think that's funny. If I trade stocks in LLC structure as a C Corp, how can I be taxed on the quadrants instead of the S? Oh, they're using trade talk and I'm not getting it. So I don't know. Hey, when you have an LLC for your trading, the exchanges want to consider you a professional. And for the data feeds, I'm fighting on that right now. So Sherry, so here's what you do. They are all going to this methodology where if you're a business entity, they want to hit you as a professional because they don't know. There's so many LLCs that were lying that they're saying that they were trading it for their account and then they had all these funds and everything else. And these guys are basically just trying to find a way to make some more revenue. So what I do is I ignore the LLC for the TD Ameritrade. I'll open that up as a grantor trust, just as a regular old trust, like you would a living trust. They're going to say, who's the beneficiary? You're going to say yourself. And then when they ask for the tax ID, you use the tax ID of the LLC, if that's the easiest route. And then you assign the beneficiary. As soon as you open up the account, you assign the beneficial interest to the LLC. And that way they never know the LLC exists. They just think you're just a regular old trust and they treat you really good. Some of them are getting sticky, and it can depend on the broker, it can depend on the company, but I've seen that pop up enough over the last year where it seems to be a new trend. It's annoying. A lot of big mess. Yeah, so real easy. We'll just do, it's called a personal property trust. It's just basically a grantor, like a living trust. You're just opening up. So if they ask you to say, it's just like a living trust. It just holds my trading account. And then you just show them, hey, here's what it is. It looks all good. And we just make the beneficiary, the LLC. All right. So we have a few more questions here. Okay. Property solely used for Airbnb. All right. So here's the question. Can you depreciate a property that is used for short-term rentals like Airbnb? So here's the issue. If your average rental is 7 days or less, then the answer is no. They treat you like a hotel. If your average rental is greater than 7 days, then the answer is yes. The problem with Airbnb is the average rental is about 3 days. So unless yours is way different, chances are you are going to be treated as a hotel and you get taxed, self-employment tax, and you lose depreciation, 1031 exchanges, all that stuff. There is a workaround. You know, we have a bunch of videos out there on the in our YouTube channel that you can find on Airbnb. But the workaround in a nutshell is you lease it long to your own corporation. So it's usually I have an LLC and I lease it to my corporation. My corporation is now the host and it does the smaller. So you get to treat it as a long-term rental, even though the corporation is now the hotel. That's basically how you do it in a nutshell. All right. Can an LLC owned by spouses be a disregarded entity? John, the answer is yes. If you are in a community property state, both spouses can be owners of it, and it's treated as a disregarded entity, which means it doesn't file a tax return. Everything flows onto your personal return. If you are in a separate property state, then you need to have a living trust, and one spouse's trustee could own it on behalf of the trust, which you're both beneficiaries of. And then from a tax standpoint, the IRS treats that as a single taxpayer, and it can be disregarded. If you're in a separate property state and you do not have a living trust, then you would both be owners and it would be treated as a partnership and file a 1065. Hope that makes sense. For tax deed with redemption rights, is it better to be a disregarded entity under a Wyoming holding partnership or to be a disregarded entity under an S-Corp? So if I'm doing tax deeds and I'm going to redeem them, I mean, first off, a tax deed is interest income. So chances are I'm going to have that flowing through to me. I don't want it to be an S or C corp because that's portfolio income. It's interest. So that's actually good for me. So I would, generally speaking, I would put that into a holding entity. An LLC in Wyoming is probably a good idea. And if I want more tax benefits and I want to have a centralized management, I'd probably have an S or a C corp managing that. I tend to like that structure. See, what if you have a C corp and this year you did nothing with it? Do you still have to pay quarterly taxes? No. In fact, you don't have to pay quarterly taxes if last year you didn't pay any taxes. That's always the catch.
That's not true for corporations.
For corporations, what are they?
There's no prior safe harbor for the corporation if your income was zero.
So what do we have?
Or if your tax was zero. So it can be based on prior year if you paid tax in the prior year.
But if you didn't have any, if you didn't pay tax, or let's say you had prior year you had taxes, and this year you have nothing going on, do you still have to pay quarterly taxes?
No.
All right. So we're in agreement on that one. But if you think you're going to make a bunch of money this year and you didn't pay any, and you didn't have any taxes last year,
then you have to make estimates based on your current year income.
Just remember, this is a pay-as-you-go system and you get a reprieve for the most part when you first start. But once you have a history, then you got to be careful. But if you think you're not going to be paying anything and you didn't pay anything, you don't have to pay taxes if you're not making the money. And frankly, remember, your penalty is based on underpayment. So if you don't underpay, then there's no penalty. So if you don't have any taxes, there's no underpayment penalty. So if it's just chilling there, chilling like a villain. All right, let's see. Move to Puerto Rico. Oh, somebody is talking about paying less tax. You got to live in Puerto Rico if you're going to do that 4% tax. That's Act 22 and 20. You got to live there 183 days, I think is what it is. You actually have to be physically there. I own free and clear land as an individual. Would like to sell my land to an LLC and then work with my partner as a builder to build homes, then sell those homes through an LLC. What is the tax ramification of doing this? Melena, actually, that's a pretty good question. If you're going to subdivide land in six or more lots, then you're a dealer. So, or if you're going to develop the property, you're going to sell land and then put a bunch of properties on it and sell those. That's also dealership activity. If you want to cut it into pieces, you sell the land to an S corp or a C corp. That's what you're doing with your partner. And that way you get the long-term capital gains on the sale of that point. And then that's the entity that does the development. And then the improved value above the value of the land is what would be subject to the active ordinary income. But since it's going through a corporation, we can then control that. So we've done a bunch of videos on those two, on how to do those types of transactions. It's not horrifically difficult. It's just understanding that when you are an investor, you want to make sure you remain an investor. And when you're a developer, you want to make sure that you're doing that to an SRC court. Okay, it says, what if you don't own the property on a short-term rental? Is there any difference if you don't own the property? I'm trying to think of how this works. So let's say you lease the property and you're doing it, then it's just active income. You don't have to worry about depreciation. If you are the owner of the property and you're leasing it to somebody who then turns it into Airbnb, you could still depreciate it. And then says something about what kind of trust you guys need for holding a trading account to get around the fees. You would need a personal property trust, Keith. We do them all the time for our trading clients. We have quite literally, if not, probably more than 1,000 traders, I would guesstimate. How many returns are you doing on traders that have trading income right now?
Quite a few. I really don't have a number on
It's hundreds that we've done with that. It works like a charm. Tax credit lost if you don't file first year. Tax credit. First year tax credit. They may be thinking of
startup costs.
That's the only thing I could think of.
Yeah.
So when you have a startup cost, so when you're doing startup costs in a business, and boy, we're getting late again. We're a little over. So I think we'll wrap this one up. We'll use this as our wrap up. Unless you guys have if somebody has a super pressing question, ask it now or forever hold your peace. But if you are, when you start up your business, you have to elect the startup costs and the organizational costs in the first year. Is the organizational costs for sure in first year? I think both of them do. You have 5,000 for each.
The startup costs, definitely.
Startup costs. I think on both, you just have to say, hey, I'm going to write this off. Otherwise, it's added into the basis of the company.
Right.
So you have to do that. Somebody says, is a discredited LLC the best entity to have to put your kids to work? So there's two rules. So if I have kids that are going to work for my company and I want to pay them a salary, a lot of you guys know that I do this with my daughter when she went to college, pay her a certain amount of money that she pays tax at her level, as opposed to me paying her tuition out of my tax bracket, I'd have to run it through payroll. If you don't want to run it through payroll, then the exception is you have a sole proprietorship that's owned by you and you employ your kids, then you don't have to do the withholding and the self-employment tax and all that fun stuff. I can just pay them. And so, you would set up a disregarded LLC and you'd pay it, but you'd both be working for it. It'd be your LLC, or you have your child own their own LLC and have them do lots of work for other people too and grow their own business. You could do that too. Question, are we able to take unreimbursed accountable plan expenses, office space against W-2 income?
As of 2018, no, that's gone.
Yeah, so Joseph, we used to have unreimbursed business expenses that you'd take on your Schedule A, and under the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, they removed that. That is gone. Can you deduct a meal?
Eating at home if you're working on an out-of-town client, no.
Yeah, that's good. James, you're getting creative.
You actually have to be out of town.
Yeah, you have to be. So when you're traveling, you can write off meals. They're 50% deductible. Otherwise, you have to be conducting business. So if you had the out-of-town client with you and you're eating, then the answer is yes. And now we have a bunch of questions popping in. Let's see. When you buy new real estate and do cost segregation, will the depreciation start new for the new asset without being affected from the prior depreciation?
I don't think there would be prior depreciation.
So this is how it works. Depreciation, this is going to sound funny, but you depreciate it. And then whenever we want to re-depreciate it, you sell it to something else and you start your depreciation all anew. Generally speaking, we're selling it to, they're doing a 1031 exchange. If you're doing a 1031 exchange, then the old depreciation flows through. I've never seen a cost segregation done on the old property that's been exchanged into the new. So under the old...
I don't think you're going to be able to do that because you don't own the property anymore.
Right. You're rolling the old basis into the new one. So I don't think you can go back and redo it.
Right.
Maybe you could. But
It's not so much that you're rolling the depreciation. You're rolling the old basis less. The depreciation.
Right. Well, aren't you rolling the depreciation forward?
Well, you can do that under one of the props. You can elect to roll the depreciation.
Yeah, you'd have to. So that's kind of a novel concept. I'd have to look at that. I mean, I suppose that you could do it.
I think you would have to do the change of accounting method before you actually sold the property.
Yeah, you'd probably. Yeah, I see what you're saying. So you'd do the.
So you could actually do that as of the day that you sold the property. But once the property sold, I don't know that you could any longer do that.
Right. So you bought the new property and your depreciation of the old and the basis rolled of the old property rolled into the new. And so I don't know the answer off the top of my head whether you'd be able to do the accelerated depreciation. I imagine you could, but it would be on the old property. So you'd probably have to do it before you bought the new property. It gets kind of funky, but it's very interesting. That's something I might look at and see if I can answer next time.
So if you're buying a property that you're considering doing a cost seg on,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to have an appraisal anyway for a loan or whatever to buy this property,
mm-hmm.
do you find somebody who can do appraisals and cost segs at the same time?
Well, the cost seg is going to be an engineer, or it's going to be software overseen by a tax professional. So it's not going to be the appraisal.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be very different. What I'm doing is I'm saying what items are what. So they don't really care about the value. They're saying, here's the items.
Right.
They may be valuing them from a certain standpoint. I guess they would be to a certain standpoint. But what they're really doing is they're breaking out which items in the property are less than.
Yeah, and I guess that's true because most of the appraisers are looking at an overall value of the property based on comparables
yep.
and such.
And they have different methodologies for doing it. Let's see, if you pay your 19-year-old child to work for your LLC, would this be classified as a management fee? No, Cassandra, you'd be paying them for whatever service they actually provide. Do I need to recapture the depreciation? No, on a 1031 exchange, you don't have to recapture depreciation in a 1031 exchange until you sell it. And then when you do sell and you don't 1031 exchange, then you have to recapture. If you die, you don't have to, the whole basis steps up and your kids can re-depreciate it. That sounds really horrible, but that's kind of the whole reason why you never sell the properties. You want to hold on to them. Let's see. And then if you do another exchange, you could exchange and exchange and exchange and exchange, and you're never going to have depreciation recapture. The only time you'll have depreciation recapture, if you quit 1031 exchange and you sell a property, then you're going to be recapturing all of it from day one. What is the qualified charitable distribution and why is it limited to $100,000? That's out of a retirement plan. I think that is what he's talking about. And so what it goes like this, when I am over 70 and a half and I have to take required minimum distributions, that required minimum distribution does two things. A, it's taxable at my ordinary bracket, so it's going to be taxed a lot, but it can also make my Social Security income or other income taxed at a higher amount. So right now, if I get Social Security, there's a good chance I'm not going to pay tax on it. If I go over 40,000 bucks or whatnot, now I'm going to be paying tax on 85% of it.
Right.
So what some people do instead is they say, I don't need the money. I don't want to pay extra tax on my Social Security, and I don't need the money coming out of my retirement plan. Frankly, they're forcing me to take it. So rather than have me pay tax on it, I give it all to charity. Normally, my charitable donation is limited to 60% of my adjusted gross income. When you do it out of your IRA or your 401k, then I don't have to count that as income to me. I don't even have to report it.
You just got to make sure the money goes straight from your IRA to the charity.
Yep. It does not go to you and then you donate it. It goes straight to the charity. Can the qualified charitable deduction exceed the required minimum distribution? Yes, actually it can. So you can give, if I have a whole bunch in my retirement plan and I want to start giving it out to the charity, could I start doing that now and depleting my retirement plan? Yeah. So I think
right.
You can. You're just limited on the dollar amount. So you can't give your whole retirement plan to the charity. They won't let you do that, but they will let you do $100,000 a year. So hope that makes sense. All right. In 2 weeks, we'll be back again. Ask your questions to Tax Tuesday at Anderson Advisors. We do have somebody looking at all of them and pushing it. If it's a very extensive question, we kick it over to the advisors. If it's a simple question, then we go over them on this. And when I say simple, it doesn't have your personal stuff all over it. It's not like, I don't want to have you guys ask a question and then have your personal thing all over the internet. So what I do is I try to keep those ones separate. But if it's fairly simple, then we grab them. Do ask your question, though. We will make sure it does get answered. If it's a very extensive question, then again, we may ask you to join the Platinum so that you can get a personalized answer on much more detail. Otherwise, Jeff, do you have anything else?
No, I'm going to go take a nap. I'll see you all in 2 weeks.
We'll see you guys in 2 weeks. Jeff is a trooper. Finishes last night, probably around midnight, done with the tax deadline, dealing with all that fun stuff. So we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. Show notes for links to everything mentioned in this episode can be found on our website at AndersonAdvisors.com/podcast. Be sure you subscribe to our podcast. And if you are already a subscriber, please provide us a review of what you thought of this episode.